Everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep. To everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. To everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time of love, a time of hate, a time of war, a time of peace. A time you may embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. To everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow, a time for love, a time for hate, a time for peace. I swear it's not too late. Hello, everyone. This is the New American Dream Radio Show. I am Chuck Gregory. And we're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We've had interesting 3 or 4 weeks with our sound issues, and we're hoping that we have it all solved tonight. We will find out as we go through the show. Last week, I broadcast from the Betsy Hotel in South Beach at a tribute for Sherwood Ross, who was one of our first columnists, and he was on the first week of every show for many a year. But we move on now. And I am pleased, proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome these special guests, Michael Annis, Karen Kotowski, Julius Alafong, and Anthony Rayson. So this Thursday evening, we're gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, in northern Minnesota, in Chicago, Illinois, in Denver, Colorado, in Mount Jackson, Virginia, in Yaoundé, Cameroon, and wherever you are. The latest issue of Pen Magazine is now available. A good book can bring an empire to its knees. Pen Magazine, P-E-N-N, magazine.us. Okay, just a little bit here to go back to the basics about what we're trying to do here on the show. We've been doing this since 2011. We'll be coming up to our anniversary soon in February. What we're trying to do is to fill the gap because the mainstream media don't do their job. What don't they do? What they don't do is to tell the truth. And we might have made some inroads a couple of years ago. Nobody ever said out loud conspiracy theory or deep state or fake news. And those terms right now are being widely misused or mocked, ridiculed, or turned totally around to mean something different. But still, we have made some progress. For some reason, the so-called real press in this country do not tell the truth about Oswald, Sirhan, Bin Laden, James Earl Ray, Paul Wellstone, 9/11. The list goes on. Heard it many times before. Oklahoma City, Boston, Sandy Hook, the war, so-called war on terror, Russia. The list is really long. If they did tell the truth, this show would not be needed, but they do not, and we are here, and we are so glad to be here as well. We're going to now try to contact Anthony Rasin in Chicago, our first guest. Anthony Rasin is a retired toll booth operator on the Chicago freeways. Anthony is a writer and an activist. He publishes zines. He publishes these small magazines, and he produces largely the writings of prisoners. He has communicated with many, many prisoners over the years in many of the prisons, federal and state prisons of the United States. And these people, men and women, will write back to him, and Anthony will choose some to publish, and he'll send those around the country and also back into the prison. And we are able to hear about Anthony's work and his progress and how things are going each month from Chicago. And so now we're going to try to contact Anthony Rasin in Chicago.
Hi, this is Anthony. Please leave a message and I'll get back to you later. Thanks. Bye.
At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
All right, we'll get this right in a second.
If you are satisfied with your message, press 1 to listen to your message. Press 2 to erase and re-record. Press 3 to continue recording where you left off. Press 4. Are you still there? If you are satisfied with your message, press 1 to listen to your message. Press 2 to erase and re-record. Press 3 to continue recording where you left off. Press 4. Are you still there? If you are satisfied with your message, press 1 to listen to your message. Press 2 to erase and re-record.
What?
Press 3 to
hang on.
Where you left off. Press 4. Sorry, oh. You're having trouble. Your message has been sent. Goodbye.
Finally. All right, folks. Here we go again. We're going to try to get the right number for Anthony this time. I don't know why that didn't work, but I'm going to try it again. Just give me a second. Sorry about this, folks. Skype has made life much more difficult, and it's really hard to add the extra person in here. It's hard to get the right number when you have more than one for somebody. But we are going to get it. Thanks, Mike.
That was the number you sent last time.
Yeah, that's the right number. And for some reason, this keeps wanting to call the wrong one. Wait a second. Okay. Yes, that's the one.
For a collection of Anthony Rasin's writings, you can go to online to DePaul University. There's a site online that has a collection of his zines. And also some more biographical information on Anthony Rasin. Skype won't let you call that number, is that right?
Yeah, it keeps wanting to call the other number that we have for him, which he is apparently not answering. I'm not sure quite what we're calling here. We'll find out.
Mailbox belonging to...
Hi, this is Anthony. Leave a message. I'll see if I can figure out how to get back to you.
Is full and cannot accept new messages at this time. Please try again later.
tell you, we have worse luck getting hold of Anthony lately.
Chuck, do you know if you're dialing that new number, or is it possible to...
Let me just dial a number and add it. It used to do all kinds of things, and now it's, they have to change everything and improve it. You know how that is. All right, let me see here. Wait. Well, it let me call Anthony directly, but it wouldn't let me add him to this call. I really don't know how to do this. It's something has changed in the way that they're doing Skype. Are you there?
So he was at. Yeah, I'm here.
He was at
the number. Or?
He was at that number. Let me try something. Let me try something else. Hang on.
Okay.
Hello, Anthony. It's Chuck and Mike, and I found a way around this. I called you on my other phone, and I'm going to hold it up to the microphone. So sorry about all the trouble getting to you, but go for it.
Okay, well, thanks very much. The Countrywide Prison Strike has begun starting Tuesday, August 21st. Which is the anniversary of the murder of George Jackson. It's going on in several states and into Canada and even Europe. It's going to last until September 9th, which is the anniversary of Attica. So I suggest folks just Google prison strike. The UK Guardian is reporting on it and interviewed Kevin Johnson, a brilliant prisoner activist. And it was even mentioned in USA Today, so I guess they realize they can't really suppress it this time. It could very well turn out to be the biggest prison strike in American history. Well, I sort of work in the shadows. I'm sort of organizing behind the scenes. And I go by Malcolm X, who said that before the masses can move, they need to discover their own humanity. So that's kind of where I come in. I'm very busy in the shadows of people's minds, mostly prisoners. So I thought I'd read a few letters from prisoners, give you an idea of what their mindset is. This one, I just started a relationship with this guy. His name is Jeerdon Hutchins. He's a prisoner in Missouri. He says, mental health says thinking distortion. I'd say thoughts of an anarchist. My brother said, we love you, soldier. I must be doing something right. From a soldier in solidarity, which man of the underground information highway? Well, that's high praise. My greetings, comrade. DIY, do it yourself. A punk anarcho principle that every true anarchist should live by. Sometimes, most of the time, my words fall on deaf ears as they try and penetrate the foggy, psychotropic, drug-induced mind of the common young prisoner and bring him out of his coma-like state. It can be very frustrating, like trying to light a firecracker that's been soaked in the rain for 3 days. But I'll continue to be an agitator and abolitionist in the face of government. For if I shut my lips, the truth will burn in the marrow of my bones. I will continue to let my voice boom through these supermax hallways, torture chambers, rattling doors, and shaking the pillars of oppression. We have nothing to lose because they took it all already. Let's give them our blood and the breath of our lungs. If we cannot live like men, let's die like warriors. Yes, I cannot help but be a firebrand in the slave state of Missouri that lights a fire up under the ass of those walking dead, passive, submissive street punks who always pick the wrong time to be humble. Every night I will continue to whisper to you in the shadows, you are a slave. Master will be around in a minute to count his money so that you may never forget. My aim of global anarchy may be centuries away, but I won't get anywhere laying on my ass reading U.S. Weekly, and neither will you. From the cradle to the grave, resist, rebel, revolt, refuse. The black ball in the corner of my cage lets me know Big Brother is watching. He has an interest in me, The only reason I have not cheated him out of his money is because my people need for me to do that which they are afraid of, a sacrifice, a direct hit. The preacher man threatens me with images of hell from his dusty Greek Septuagint. He has no idea what hell is. Every day we wake up in hell. As James Scott so beautifully stated, my mind is free, but I want my body free too. Satan unlocks my chuck hole and Lucifer brings me my tray. I do not care for etiquette and formalities. Tell me the truth. My fellow slaves, you make me want to hurt you sometimes, but I love all you crazy motherfuckers. This is my dysfunctional family, smile. For all my callous, hardened convict demeanor, I cannot help but hold back tears when I see the images of the children. Such innocent, trusting, dependent sparks of life. There's nothing like it. Then this government issues your child a social security tracking number, a property title birth certificate. You might as well have stamped a barcode on the backs of their necks. If you won't stand up for yourself, then stand up for your children. The revolution is not as hard as all these revolutionary scientists make it sound. Simply stop what you are doing and do nothing. Do nothing at all. If you don't turn the gears of the machine, then the system does not work. Industry screeches to a halt. When you stop, the world stops. The perpetration of your miserable wage slave existence is entirely dependent on your cooperation. You are more powerful than you know, and if you starve to death, then die and let our corpses form a human fortress around the next generation. Peace, love, and solidarity, my black, white, brown, red, and yellow brothers. Did I miss anyone? They wrote a little piece called Hot Tears of Rage. He's a brilliant artist, by the way. I'm going to work up some incredible publications with him in the coming months. Anyway, Hot Tears of Rage. I would rather be playing with my three nieces having a tea party. Instead, I am caged in a Supermax warehouse indefinitely for responding to violence with violence. I would rather be playing catch with my five nephews running and laughing. Instead, I am getting gassed and drenched in pepper spray for refusing to submit to a dehumanizing strip search. I would much rather take a long ride down I-70 with my younger brother reminiscing on the good times. Instead, he's locked down in the feds and I'm locked down in the state of misery. Hands that would once uplift, hold, and comfort, now bruised, calloused, and stained with the blood of my enemies. Traumatized by the American nightmare, I cry hot tears of rage. I'm an abolitionist, an endangered species. I'm an anarchist, civilization's last hope for survival. Well, so that's a little piece of Jordan's thinking. Here's a follow-up. His name is Dmitry Harzewski. He's a prisoner in Ione, California. Says, dear Anthony, I had this address. I hope this address and you are still good. It's been a few years since I've written to you, and even though nothing changes for me in that amount of time, I still know that a lot of goes on in real life, so I have no idea how this letter finds you. Are you still destroying? It was a hell of a project for so long, I hate to think things might have changed much. No, they haven't. We're going good. If it's still possible to get a hold of some of the great material you made available a few years ago, I'd love to request a few zines again. Is there a new catalog? I can send a few stamps. I've done a ton of reading and thinking since our last correspondences. A lot of things you wrote to me over the years, plus what's been in your personal zines, obviously, had a big impact on my thinking. More importantly, though, what you've done and shown by example gave me a great model for what people can do if they just care. I may never get out of this cage. In fact, hello?
Yeah, you're still there.
Excuse me?
You're still there. Go on.
Okay. In fact, if things in society don't change radically, I probably won't. My Supreme Court petition was denied this year. But I want to do whatever I can with my life from now on to, I'd like to know how to put it really, to transmit some ideas. Encourage some values, anarchist ideas, anarchist values. Every time I look around, I see people right here with me who might be at the crossroads of some kind, and they're taken in by the authoritarian mentalities of the prisoners who have the most influence. Or lately, they've turned into self-loathing, obsequious little mind puppets by all the programs people are being coerced into under the new laws and rules over the past couple of years that make it possible to cut most prison sentences in California by amounts never dreamed of before. actually getting parole dates now. And determinant sentences are now eligible for 30, 40, 50, even 60%+ off of original release dates. Guys with 10 or 20 years ago. I'm always glad to see people escape their living death in slavery sooner than they expected, but I mean, could the cost be too high at some point? Everything that's required to get folks out sooner is also blatantly geared toward making them weak, compliant, and even complicit in their misery machine. It would be hard enough to get 3 years of the victimologist and authoritarian propaganda and indoctrination without being badly affected by so much brainwashing. But you could guess most of the victims of this exploitation don't even try to prevent their infection. Hell, most have no clue that there's anything to prevent it, you know? It genuinely hurts me to see this, not just because of the waste of life on those people, but the waste of life they'll inevitably contribute to others over time. I want to counter that somehow.
We'll be right back after this message. With a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And now it's time again for the George Carlin Back to School special sale on folders and pencils and lunchboxes and backpacks. Tell your children's teachers and principals and school board what you really think about them and their little school and little classroom with these special messages on the pencils and folders and lunchboxes and backpacks that will fall apart conveniently before next fall so you can buy more cheap crap. From Walmart and Target, your school supplies buddies. Some sample selections from the George Carlin Target and Walmart Back to School special sale on folders and pencils and lunchbox and backpacks. Get a pack of 100 number 2 pencils with this special little message that your child can see every time she tries to calculate 2 plus 2. There's a reason that education sucks. It's never going to be fixed. There's nothing you can do about it. The owners of this country don't want that. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking, well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. Get a new backpack with this message for everyone on the bus. They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting screwed by a system that threw them overboard 30 freaking years ago. They don't want that. Take home 20 multicolored notebooks and folders to hold all your child's important papers with this familiar old American saying. You know what they want? They want obedient workers, people who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all those increasingly crappier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. They own this freaking place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
And now, from the actual American History Channel, tonight we will hear an excerpt from the book Disturbing the Peace. Sponsored by Powder Milk, Democrat gonads, heavens, they're pasty. Voice for the Voiceless, Fort Benning, Georgia, August 9, 1983. The summer sun was finally setting. It was time to act. Time to engage the Salvadoran troops. Roy Bourgeois was ready, but he was not so sure that Larry Rosebough could penetrate base security. Rosebough, a gentle oblate priest who had worked with street people in Brazil, reminded Bourgeois of St. Francis. Even in the battle dress uniform Bourgeois had purchased for him at the local army surplus store, Rosebough did not exactly present a military bearing. It would take a small miracle for the MPs to mistake him for an army officer. Linda Ventimiglia, an army reserve officer, would not be a problem. She and Bourgeois, a former Navy lieutenant, had given Rosebough a crash course on military decorum and worked on his salute. The three had also practiced scaling trees in an Alabama pine forest. And Bourgeois finally decided they were as ready as they were going to be. He went over the details of their plan one last time, then double-checked the supplies. Pepper, a rope ladder, tree climbers, high-powered Sony cassette player with four speakers. And most important, the tape recording.
As night fell, the three set out, dressed as high-ranking officers with insignia also purchased at the Army surplus store. They loaded their equipment in the Land Rover of a friend who had agreed to drive them to the base. Bourgeois braced himself as they neared the entrance. The Land Rover had a Fort Benning sticker, but an MP at the checkpoint seemed to eye them suspiciously. Then, to their amazement, he snapped a salute. Theirs were a little shaky. The driver eased onto the base, passing several warning signs that said they were entering a restricted area and unauthorized persons would be prosecuted. The vehicle stopped near a tank trail in the wood. There, the three quickly gathered their equipment and began walking down the trail that led to the quarters of several hundred Salvadoran soldiers. Soon, the lights of the barracks became visible and the three edged closer, looking for a suitable tree. After they agreed on a towering 100-foot pine, Rosebough sprinkled pepper on the ground to prevent guard dogs from picking up their scent. Bourgeois, meanwhile, strapped the tree climbers to his boots and began scaling the pine. After securing his footing, he dropped the rope ladder for Ventimiglia and Rosebough. As he did, he broke a branch. Instantly, German shepherds began barking at a nearby MP station. Ventimiglia and Rosebough slowly climbed up and then tossed the rope ladder to the ground. Bourgeois anchored the tape player high in the tree, aiming at the barracks. Then there was a collective sigh of relief. They had gotten into the belly of the beast.
Bourgeois, a Marienhall priest, silently prayed that no one would get shot and reminded himself of the reasons they were taking such risks. It was not complicated. The U.S. military was training a brutal foreign army on U.S. soil, an army that served a small Salvadoran elite who lived in splendor while the poor lived in squalor, an army that had butchered thousands of innocent people, including women and children, priests and nuns, an army that had raped and murdered two of his friends. The weight in the trees felt interminable. The three kept shifting their weight to get comfortable. Suddenly, the barracks lights went out. Finally, the moment had come. The three steeled themselves as Bourgeois reached up and pressed the play button on the tape player, saying, "Oscar, this is for you." Moments later, the voice of the dead Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero boomed in Spanish from the treetops, shattering the silence below. I would like to make a special appeal to the members of the Army, and specifically to the ranks of the National Guard, the police, and the military. Brothers, each one of you is one of us. We are the same people. The peasants you kill are your own brothers and sisters. When you hear the voice of a man commanding you to kill, remember the voice of God. Thou shalt not kill.
It was the Archbishop's last Sunday homily, delivered in the San Salvador Cathedral on March 23, 1980. His fateful words had stung the Salvadoran military and led to his assassination the next day. Romero's words again triggered a violent reaction as they echoed through the barracks at Fort Benning, imploring the startled Salvadorans to disobey orders to kill. It was as if someone had poked a beehive. The base was abuzz. Lights beamed, sirens wailed, MPs with M16s swarmed over the grounds. But in the darkness, they had trouble locating the source of the disturbance, even with the aid of the dogs.
It was a sacred moment, Bourgeois later recalled. Those soldiers coming out of the barracks, looking into the sky, not being able to see us, hearing the words of this prophet. Finally, one of the lights fixed on the rope ladder at the base of the pine, and then illuminated the trespassers up the tree. The MPs started cursing, threatening to shoot them down, but even with weapons trained on him, Bourgeois stalled for time, hoping to play the entire homily. He shouted down they no longer had the rope ladder, and as the MPs scurried about trying to figure out what to do, the tape played over and over. No soldier is obliged to obey an order contrary to the law of God. There is still time for you to obey your own conscience, even in the face of a sinful command to kill. In the name of God, in the name of our tormented people, whose cries rise up to heaven, I beseech you, I beg you, I command you, stop the repression.
As the chaos on the ground grew, the dogs started to fight among themselves. A couple MPs tried to pull them apart, while another started to climb the pine, grabbing branches of nearby trees to pull himself up. Then another went up the rope, up with the rope ladder. Rosebaugh, whose perch was lowest in the tree, was taken down first, then Ventimiglia. Rosebaugh was strip-searched and Ventimiglia was gagged. Meanwhile, the first MP had climbed nearly 60 feet up to get Bourgeois and shut off the cassette. After Romero's voice was silenced, Bourgeois started shouting the bishop's words in Spanish, angering the MPs on the ground. When he finally descended the tree, a trainer was waiting for him.
He hit me from behind, Bourgeois said later, then threw me against a tree and stripped me. For five or six agitated dogs, about 10 MPs with M16s who were shining lights on us. The trainer got in his karate pose and wanted me to get up and fight, but his own men pulled him off. The tree climbing had shown a light on the U.S. Army's infamous School of the Americas. And as Bourgeois would learn years later, the school had in fact trained the Salvadoran officers who murdered the U.S. churchwomen and ordered the assassination of Archbishop Romero. This has been your actual U.S. American History Channel, an excerpt from the book Disturbing the Peace. Sponsored by Powder Milk Democrat Gonads. Heavens, they're pasty and expeditious.
Our next guest of the show is Karen Katowski. Karen Katowski joins us each month from Mount Jackson, Virginia. Karen is a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. She was stationed at the Pentagon on the day of September 11th, 2001. She is a radio show host, a writer, an activist. She ran for Congress at one time. And we're going to try right now to contact Karen Katowski in Virginia.
Hello?
Well, hello, Karen. It's Chuck and Mike, the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air.
Okay, I hope the sound is good because I am driving, but glad to be here. And a couple things I wanted to share with the listeners. On Saturday, last Saturday, I went to the Ron Paul Peace Institute. They have an annual conference, and the conference theme this year was media and war, and it was really good. Had some great speakers, had military people, had people from the left side of the house, media people, futurists, all kinds of folks were there. And it was wonderful to see all these folks listening to each other. And not everybody agreed with everything, but it was really good. And Lou Rockwell, I think, LouRockwell.com and the Ron Paul Institute website also are going to be releasing over the next week, I guess, various speeches. And there's some that I think people really, the listeners are really be interested in. And there's two anecdotes or two stories, no, three that I want to share. Hopefully I can get it in. One of the speakers was Caitlin Johnstone, and she's from Australia. I don't know if you've heard of her, but if you haven't, really, you should follow her on Twitter, because the day before the conference, she got banned by Twitter. And there was a revolt by her 37,000 followers, and they turned the ban into a 12-hour suspension and got her back on. She is a person who, while she is Australian, she follows American politics, and she understands and talks about and criticizes the oligarchy, the deep state, the way power arrangements are in this country. And some people would say that she comes from the left, maybe the anarcho-left, I'm not sure. But all I know is I agree with everything she has to say, and it's wonderful. She's quite articulate, and she did a video teleconference speech with us on Saturday, and she's absolutely wonderful. So if she's basically a jewel. If anybody is interested in learning more and finding the words to explain and critique what we see happening in this country, in our society, in our politics, she's a person. Caitlin Johnstone, so Google her. That was great. We also had John Whitehead, who is the head of the Rutherford Institute here in Charlottesville, Virginia. And the Rutherford Institute works to preserve civil liberties. And they don't just work. They fight. They do lawsuits. They take pro bono cases. They do friendly claims or whatever, what they call it, amicus reports with, on court cases that are relating to the laws of our civil liberties. And John Whitehead is a fantastic writer and speaker. And he recently wrote about, and he talked about on Saturday, the martial law that was put in place in most of the city of Charlottesville in preparation for, I guess they expected to, it was the 1 year anniversary of what had happened with statues and the alt-right versus the Antifa, or I don't know who all it was, but a lot of people fighting. One person got run over by a car or hit by a car and then died. And so there was a death, obviously, and this is obviously not right. In anticipation of the anniversary of that event, they basically declared martial law, and they brought in cops from everywhere, all over outstate, in-state, and they clamped down, and they shut down Charlottesville. A good much of Charlottesville was shut down. And this is not something that should be normal. Our government should not be capable of doing this kind of thing. But it does, and it can, and it's easier and easier every time it does it. I know a lot of people in Rutherford, the Rutherford Institute, and John Whitehead wrote about this years ago when there were the attacks at the Boston Marathon some years ago, and they locked down Boston and suspended everybody's civil rights, went door to door. That was a situation that was really big, and the ease with which our government, state, local, and federal, working together, could completely lock down a city the size of Boston. You should be frightened to see this. You should be scared when you see this. And John reminded us that it's coming to much smaller towns. And they are perfecting. They're perfecting the SWAT teams. They're perfecting the technology. They're perfecting the control. and we as citizens are getting used to it and we're accepting it. So that was something. And then, and actually, I encourage everybody to check out anything by John Whitehead at the Rutherford Institute, because he is crying in the wilderness to let us know what's happening to our freedoms in this country. And I'm not sure how many people are really listening. The head guy that works for, he kind of works for Ron Paul, and he's just the MC of the, introducing the various speakers.
Karen, are you still there? I think we have lost Karen. Maybe we got a bad spot in the cell. I'm going to try to add her one more time. But while I'm doing that, let me mention. You know, she was talking about the all these places where we just go along with the government.
You have reached the voicemail box of 540-333-1459. At the tone, please record your voice message. When you are finished recording, you may hang up or press pound for more options.
Well, anyway, what I wanted to say is that we really enjoyed having Karen on, and we hope to get her back on if we can get this thing to connect up to her again. She was talking about the... hang on, I think she's calling in.
To send your message, press 1 at any time. To listen to your message, press 2. To re-record, press 3. For more options, press 4. To cancel, press star.
I'd be all set here.
To send your message, press 1 at any time. To listen to your message, press 2. To re-record, press 3. For more options, press 4.
Sure,
to cancel, press star.
what? But we'll
to send your message, press 1 at any time. To listen to your message, press 2. To re-record, press 3. For more options, press 4. To cancel, press star.
Well, let's just try to continue.
Sorry, please try again later. Thank you for calling. Goodbye.
Gave up. All right. Okay. Yeah, you were just talking about John Whitehead, and while I was trying to get connected again, I was mentioning to our listeners that you know, we not only accept this government shutting down our cities or whatever, pretty much whenever they feel like it. It's gotten to the point where people welcome it, where a large percentage of the population, I think more than half, actually think, oh, this is a wonderful thing. They're protecting us. And that is scary.
Right. I think you're right. I spoke to a lady a week ago, last week, and she was explaining to me, listen to the speaker, you know, Shenandoah County is a far suburb from D.C., and so she was saying, yeah, if there's ever a problem in D.C., we don't have to worry because the sheriff is going to control all the entry and exit to our whole county.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what?
Uh-huh.
I mean, first off, he's not going to be able to do that. And second off, why would you want to pay for and have a militarized police to do that? But no, they don't understand it. You're right. They get a sense of security from this kind of thing. And it's really, you know, our founders, the forefathers, they would be appalled.
Yeah.
You know, they would say, you know, there's no revolution. You guys deserve the British. Keep them.
Right.
They wouldn't appreciate how people think today. But the other thing that I was going to mention relates to this, and I'll try to think what it was. One of the guys that Daniel, the other thing I wanted to talk about was Daniel McAdams' family flying home. He had a TSA altercation. He wrote about it in a Lou Rockwell blog. You can find it today. We can look for it tomorrow. I do think people should read it because it's a first-person account of one of the many hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of of citizen interactions with the TSA, which are extremely awful, extremely abusive. We have no rights, we have no liberty, and children are involved. Of course, children are getting the same treatment. But the interesting part of it to me is what Daniel wrote in his story about what happened to him when he flew back from D.C. to Texas on Sunday, last Sunday, after the conference, was that when they finally got to the point, he didn't get arrested, but they did have to have a TSA supervisor come out. The guy was 60 years old, so he's seen the world before TSA. He might have
thought
of what free travel looks like in his life. And Daniel said, how did we evolve to this point? Daniel's very upset. I mean, his daughter, you got to read this thing. It's not good. So he's commiserating, and the 60-year-old TSA supervisor said, yes, I agree with you. I know it's wrong, but it's the law, and we have to comply. That's what he said. So, I'm sorry. It's not, I don't care if it is the law. We do not have to comply, but we are turning into a society that complies.
Yeah.
The more we comply with, the more we're going to get to comply to.
You bet.
I'm telling you, and we're not fighters anymore. We're not developing in our young people and in our people of any age. We're not really developing physical courage. We're not developing the kind of courage of our convictions. We think government is always going to be good automatically, when every society on the planet, in the history of the planet, has learned government cannot really be trusted. When they get a certain amount of power, it's all over, okay? Your rights are not going to matter. We know, I don't care what form of government you've lived under, when it gets to a certain point, it's no good. And it takes people with a little bit of backbone, spine, and courage, and maybe a shared belief in liberty and laws, really. I mean, because, seriously, TSA reaching and grabbing people, everything, seriously. That's not law. That's not protection. It's contempt. It's contempt backed by government force, paid for by the dollar, too, by the way.
Wow.
You don't pay for all of it.
That's right.
No money.
Yeah.
So it's a sad thing. And these things are very real, because it was real nice to be at the conference and listen to a great many people who they talked about war and media. That was the theme. So they were talking about what's going on in Iran and the tendencies of the media to couch out to the government, as it always has for my lifetime. But really, the real true life stories that emerged, either stories people said that happened to them, like in Charlottesville with John Whitehead, or the story afterwards with what happened to Daniel McGowan's family with the TSA on his way home. These stories, I think, are really powerful, and they're happening to regular people. They look just like you and me. They're no different than anybody else. They're just us. They're just people. And bad things are happening to them, and bad things will happen to all of us if we don't wake up. So,
indeed, indeed. Well, Karen, thank you so much. If you were to check out the first show of our, actually either of the first two shows, because we replayed it, of this month, you could hear Ava Bird talking about her TSA experience, in which she did get arrested. So check it out. Yeah. Okay, thank you. You too. We look forward to talking to you again next time. And thanks for your insights. Very interesting, as always. Bye-bye now.
Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, the Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Wadia will remain a dictatorship. Or be quiet. Why are you guys so anti-dictators? Imagine if America was a dictatorship. You could let 1% of the people have all the nation's wealth. You could help your rich friends get richer by cutting their taxes and bailing them out when they gamble and lose. You could ignore the needs of the poor for healthcare and education. Your media would appear free, but would secretly be controlled by one person and his family. You could wiretap phones. You could torture foreign prisoners. You could have rigged elections. You could lie about why you go to war. You could fill your prisons with one particular racial group, and no one would complain. You could use the media to scare the people into supporting policies that are against their interests.
Tune in Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for Liberation Nation with Deacon John, where America comes to hear the truth.
I know this is hard for you Americans to imagine, but please try.
Ohio Exo Politics will be on from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A. Mark Steyer will have guests on that will discuss many important topics, including the state of the world today. However, much of the show will be dedicated to the writings of Edward Albert Meyer. Let me read a short passage from one of his writings. Love is the highest principle of creation, and through it, everything exists in absolute logic. All of nature in its indescribable splendor is nothing but the love of creation, which is expressed visibly. The love of creation is everywhere, because without it, nothing at all would be able to exist. Please join Mark on Ohio Exopolitics from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
My next guest for the show is Michael Annis. Michael Annis joins us each month from Denver. He's the executive editor of Howling Dog Press. He is a poet and activist, and we're going to join Michael Annis right now in Denver.
Hello. Well, hello, Michael. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air.
Hi, Chuck. Hi, Mike. Tonight, I'm returning to Brave New World Order, Chapter 28, simply titled War. I'll do the first part this Thursday night, the evening, and we'll finish it or conclude it next Thursday evening. War was originally written in protest against Operation Desert Storm, and then it was applied to Iraq, and unfortunately has been necessary to update it accordingly as the decades roll out. There is one quote in this poem by the great French writer Louis Ferdinand Céline from his book Journey to the End of the Night. And usually quotes begin the piece, but this one serves better internalized within the poem as an integral part of the poem itself rather than just a forethought. So without further commentary, I will begin. Like advertisements for condoms, like B-movie bombers, came the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on homelessness, the war on sex and violence, the war on evil and the axis of evil, the war on war. The next brave new movement, Mein Kampf on trading cards, batting averages, and pink bubbles bursting onward and outward. Nationalistic slogans and Bible codes on the holy hosts of the sacrament. Take this, my brother, as you storm the Holy Land. Eat this in remembrance of him. No getting through the pearly gates without it, or forfeit those crowns. No wings, no flight glasses, no halos, no eye candy, no excuses, comrade air cowboy. No unlatching der Bustenhalter, no fiddling with the holy meat, no jacking off in the trenches, my brother, no sperma on the ground, no human tadpoles wriggling through the mud, mein Bruder. There are no atheists in foxholes, mein Braut, my bride. Du darfst die Leichen nicht quälen. You are forbidden to tantalize the corpses. You can't deny it. The war seemed to serve a purpose now and then. As for the colonel, I didn't wish him any hard luck, but he was dead too. At first I didn't see him. The blast had carried him up the embankment and laid him down on his side, right in the arms of the dismounted cavalryman, the courier, who was finished too. They were embracing each other for the moment and for all eternity, but the cavalryman's head was gone. All he had was an opening at the top of the neck with blood in it, bubbling and glugging like jam in a kettle. The colonel's belly was wide open, and he was making an ugly face about it. It must have hurt when it happened. Tough shit for him. If he'd beat it when the shooting started, it wouldn't have happened. All that tangled meat was bleeding profusely. Shells were still bursting to the right and left of the scene. Take my word for it. No atheists storm the Holy Land. No atheists liberate the little brown children, little souls winging toward the clouds, little heads on bayonets and pikes. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Champagne toasts, crystal glasses tinkling love. To make love, not war. Sloshing petroleum over the rim. Here, look, run your finger around the rim. It makes such pretty music, the music of oil, the music of war, the champagne music of noir love, the music of gold, black gold, golden love, urethra of love, golden shitstorm from the tar sands of apocalypse, Das Kapital sparkles, effervesces upon streets paved with gold, oil running freely down the gutters and sewer systems of eternity, with golden icons and golden bowls, all gold. Gold everywhere, for everyone, everyone fooled by gold. Our school colors are black, crude, and gold. Our little shoes plated with gold. Gold teeth and gold eyelashes, the glitter of gold on the cheeks, and our benefactors piss in the mouths of the hopelessly human dying of thirst. It's liquid gold, a golden fountain, a shower of... Run your finger around the rim, sweetheart. Auschwitz Fairyland, bombed-out ghettos of the Terran nightmare, so fraught with controversy, so fraught with love, so fraught with unwitting stooges, goons, hitmen, in the name of God and country, their colorful kerchiefs lynching dissenters from heaven's wincing flagpoles, in the name of the higher good, the summoned bonum, switching the channel did not dam up the blood on the block, did not cork up whirlpools of decency, churning within living rivers of routine lies and propaganda, rivers from the punctured palms of Homo Christos, mistrust overflowing scenarios of fear and dependency. We have nothing to fear but God himself. Random violence flash floods the landscape. Don't you want to be able to drive that cute car of yours, mein Fräulein, mein Schwester Zucker? Black smoke billowing from the derricks. Environmental holocaust spans the horizon. Mental holocaust mesmerizes dreams buried deep within the captivated skulls of children, little heads on pikes. In time, it will wear off. 20 year, 30 year down the road, you're going to be fine. No more shrieking yourself to wake at night. No, sir, no more shrieking to wake. It's about freedom. It's about decency. It's about the rights of the people. It's about the rights of man. It's about love, loving the rights of children to be loved, and the rights of love. Do you understand love? Multinational corporate love, sporadic aggression, the shock and awe of Gestapo raids, USA, USA, united by shock and awe. Assassinations, coups, reincarnated crusades, reinstated inquisitions, that eagle sharpening his love talons. A million Christians praying all over the face of the earth about love. A million Muslims praying all over the face of the earth about hate, obviously. And one ignorant man's tirade of self-indulgent and vengeful love. His soulful definition of universal love, bursting like meteors over the skies of Baghdad to the delight of children on the desert sands. And some are left to be found later, bursting in a child's severed hand, the burst of love. Couldn't God's will possibly be in it? It's love. God is love. God's blitzkrieg in the wee dark hours is about love. God's shock and awe of love. God's love, talking out of both sides of its mouth. We couldn't defend ourselves against anyone right now, but love conquers all. We can fight a war on two fronts if we have to, talking out of both sides of its mouth. About love. Four fronts, six fronts, eight fronts, a dollar. It's all a front about love. About military readiness. Love conquers all. About threats to corporate love. About the loving liberation of God's chosen people. The corporate benefactors of love. No time to fret about little folks whose love babies are aborted in trash cans and wheelbarrows behind the bars in the black alleys of the American corporate nightmare because their love is incomplete. They have no health insurance. Can't afford to see a doctor or fill a prescription. No, this is about global love, global security, the global village vagrants of love, pulling their love up by their bootstraps. Pitch black, magic, daylight, strobe lights, God's heavens. No place for a young terrorist to be out at night. Love. It's about peace and love. Love makes the world spin round. Ontological horror, internal vacancy, great chaotic vortices consuming them from the inside out. Peace spinning around love. The dark, insatiable vortices of peace and love. If you hear it enough, it is so. Peace and love. Rotting and poisoning them as the airwaves bled with upbeat nonsense to bury the national memory. A memory before 911 USA, 911 USA, lest we ever forget, lest we slough it off like cowards. The skeletal cell, membrane without brain, blue eyes crying in the rain. Think about it a sec. Did a single one of those terrorists have blue eyes? It's about love. It's about God's love. Jesus was God, so God had blue eyes. It's an eye for an eye. It's God's way to peace and love. It's about everybody having enough. Enough oil to make enough gas to get to work. It's about human decency, winding round the stumbling blocks of gullibility. It's about the long, hard road to love. We cut across and through the crap as the missile flies, on the firm, resolute, and bloody road of loving, paved by war and the inadequacies of truth and peace in relation to love. Viciously apprehended, scapegoats kiss the hands of corporate gangsters, throw sand in the eyes of the national dignity, peanut gallery protests of howdy-doody atrocities, as decisive and empowered as Clarabelle's seltzer bottle, as Buffalo Bob shows the exit doors to strikers and protesters, scribbling profound lines of socially conscious poetry, lamenting bungs and fenders of Audis and Chevys, and the sacred rights of women's bungholes, teachers against sexual abuse, mothers against incest, priests against child rape, poets against the war, philosophers against hate, Quakers joining forces against the opposite of love, canned laughter and tears ricocheting around a pinball universe of two-dimensional, never-ending love, introspective, extrospective realizations of self-love, embellished with buzzers, bells, and UFOs, and a bugle at sundown, and little can jazz riffs in honor of all the niggers that gave up their worthless selves in class wars that refused to go away and proclaim love. Aye, lads, aye, and an eye for an eye. Glory praise to Father Fusion by the PTL, the people that love. the PLO, the people loving others, praying for you and I. He has brought us all together now, in dread of him, in dread of love, the failure to love him, in one human bondage with one magic wand, a wand of pixie dust, love. Let us sup the cup of suicide in common. There's enough love for everyone. There's enough purple Kool-Aid for every chalice, for each set of lips, for each gut puking up love. God's love moistening every set of lips. God's love wetting the tongue in absolute corporate truth. Whether we lift hand to poison or gun, awaiting through love the radioactive third eyes, befriended by tumors and befriending them in love. We cheer on the tidy bomb, cheer on the love of human beings loving others, and loved, so very loved, so omnipotently loved by God's chosen people. No, not the Jews, the haves in their holy love war, retaining all rights to holiness against the unruly have-nots, decadent and not to be trusted. The war on unappreciativeness by God's CEOs of love.
Michael, that was quite amazing. We look forward to hearing the second half next week.
Yeah. Well, this one was pretty mild. So the second half, I'm going to kick it up a little bit.
Oh, my God. Well, if this was mild, I can't imagine what it's going to be like. Thanks again. We always appreciate you. And, hey, talk to you next week.
Okay, it's great to be on, as always. Thanks, Chuck. Thanks, Mike.
See you, Mike.
Our next guest of the show is Julius Alafong. Julius Alafong joins us each month from Yaoundé, Cameroon. And Julius sends along this introductory note about his piece tonight. I am looking at the economic and social factors as elements with much impact on the democratization process in Cameroon and most African post-colonial states. And now from Yaoundé, Cameroon, Julius Alafong.
Hello, Chuck. Hello, Mike. Good evening to you and good evening to our listeners. I'm reporting today from Douala, the economic capital of Cameroon, where I'm doing some field work, some interviews for my research, because I'm working on the conflict that exists within political parties and how they affect not only electoral outcomes, but also the nature of politics in Cameroon. So I've been interested because I've seen quite a lot of things on the ground that makes me to think about why democracy is having it hard to be effective in a country like Cameroon or in a state like Cameroon, considering the fact that we are not just a poor country, a poor and heavily indebted country. We are equally a post-colonial country. So a lot of things I've seen, and I'm greatly inspired, or we can look at this from the point of the economic and cultural requisites of democracy. And this is something that was worked on, that was highly researched by Samuel Martin Lipset. I think he was an American political scientist some two decades ago. So the factors that can easily or that can facilitate the process of the institutionalization of democracy are mostly economic and cultural variables. But we also have the method through which political parties are structured in order to maintain stability. If a political party is not properly structured, if a political party is just put in place by mimicking, by some sort of a copy and paste, because they've seen that political parties exist in some other countries, then democracies or the democratization process is bound to fail. So the first point we should note here is the fact that the process of democratization in most African countries, and Cameroon included, occurred at the same time with us when we had much profound economic crisis, that is in the early 80s and 90s. So Martin Lipset shows that it is almost impossible to have a smooth democratization process when people are poor. So the transition from an authoritarian to a democratic regime is only possible when people are financially satisfied. And he adds that the greater the affluence, the higher the rates of well-being, and this correlates with the presence of democratic institutions. So some other authors go further to say that, and I quote, "No bourgeois, no democracy." This reminds me of Joseph Stiglitz, the former vice president of the World Bank, who wrote a book entitled "The Price of Inequality." He makes us understand that when wealth is grossly unequitably distributed, we are going to have a society where everything can easily fall back into chaos. This was a comment he made after studying most Western countries. Then he went further to say that this is even worse in most African countries, where African countries are not only poor, but the gap between the rich and the poor is extremely wide. And I will add, it is not just extremely wide. These countries don't even hold their destinies into their hands. The destiny of Cameroon is not found in the hands of Cameroonians. It is found in the hands of their former colonial master, who is still, in a subtle manner, controlling what happens and what shouldn't happen in Cameroon. So in effect, Cameroonians don't have the destiny of their country in their hands. What does Karl Marx say? Karl Marx says that intense inequality is associated with scarcity, leading to a politically weak state. This also leads to political inequality. When there is economic inequality, there is automatically political inequality. When the economy of a state is controlled by a few and the middle class is left or abandoned in abject poverty, like it is our case, the state of Cameroon, we will have a very weak state. No, we have a very strong state. A strong state in the sense that, because this is very technical to understand, when a state is too strong, especially when it is too strong in the hands of a few, the majority finds it very difficult to move around and even challenge that state. The majority finds it difficult to empower themselves and fight against some of the practices of the few, those who hold government, that make them stay in poverty. This reminds me of the Industrial Revolution and the British, what you call the Green Revolution in Britain. You remember, democracy real democracy was brought in Britain through the Industrial Revolution. Because the Industrial Revolution, we are told, empowered the middle and the lower class people. When they became empowered, when they had wealth, they could educate themselves. They could understand certain things about the state. Then they started asking them questions like, why is that these guys, this few, the monarchy, is treating us this way? We have the money, we have the ideas, we know what is wrong. So that brought in a revolution wherein they created the House of Commons, where the plight of the middle class, the plight of those who don't belong to the aristocracy or the monarchy will be listened to, and solution will be brought to their problems. So that's the power behind economy. That's the power behind wealth. Wealth, because we are trying, I'm trying to link this to Martin Semu-Lipset's approach that no economy, when the economy is weak, democracy cannot take place. And I've just explained that the Industrial Revolution that permitted the growth of economy in Britain led to the installation of democracy in Britain. In fact, because some powers were reduced from the monarchy and given to the lower class. And that, so in the case of Cameroon, practically, Cameroon is still a colony to its former colonial master, that's France. Though it has been coated with the word independent country in order to deceive the people. But the exploitation tendencies, the exploitation process and control is still going on in a very subtle manner. And this through accords that were signed at the eve of independence of the French Cameroon. Moreover, Cameroon is not even a market economy. And the absence of a market economy automatically disqualifies it or disqualifies Cameroon as a country from being a political democracy. The state of Cameroon being too strong in the hands of this few sets up or is set up a circumstance where the middle class is maintained in poverty and even abject poverty, where the people are even controlled how to think, what to think, because the educational curricula does not even permit the growth of the people, the empowerment of the people. So the few wealthy guys have put a mechanism in place to bar them from coming out of ignorance, out of poverty, because coming out of this will challenge those who have a grip on the state, a grip that makes them acquire all the economic advantages to themselves and their colleagues abroad or the former colonial master. So this approach, the way Cameroon is even set up is reflected in its political parties. First of all, we should note that Cameroon is a multi-ethnic state.
We're going to have to cut short the rest of, there's only another minute and a half or so that Julius Alifong had for us. We're sorry to cut him short, but we've got to go into the station break now. So thanks for being here, folks. Talk to you on the other side of the half hour.
Find some comfort at Willow's World, a variety of news, commentary and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A. We'll be right back.
0-9-E-0-5-1-7
We talk about decentralization and bank annihilation. Bitcoin, Litecoin, MyCoin, YourCoin, Blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern Studio A.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And now we bring you the History Channel, actual American history that for some odd reason you'll never find in any American history textbook. Your hosts, Paul Craig Roberts and Barack Obama. Paul Craig Roberts was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy and Associate Editor of the Wall Street Journal. He lives in a blue house. Barack Obama lives in a White House. Well, used to live in a White House. Tonight's episode, Osama bin Laden is dead.
I am Barack Obama, and I think I'll go first because I can. Good evening. Tonight I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children.
This is Paul Craig Roberts. Before you believe your government's lies about Syria and the Ukraine, remember your government's lies about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. Remember Washington's lies about the Gulf of Tonkin that unleashed the Vietnam War. Remember the lies about Gaddafi and Libya. Remember the lies about 9/11. The lies about the murders of JFK, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. Remember the Northwoods Project that the Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted President John F. Kennedy to embrace. The Northwoods Project called for shooting down U.S. airliners, shooting down people on the streets of Miami and Washington, D.C., and strafing Cuban refugee boats in order to blame Castro and build public support for regime change in Cuba. Sound familiar? Sound like regime change in Iraq, Libya, Syria? The top secret Operation Northwoods plot against Cuba and the American people was officially released and is available online, as are numerous histories of the proposal by the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff to kill Americans in order to create support for invading Cuba. Keep this established fact in mind before you again repeat the gullible and reassuring statement, "Our government wouldn't kill its own people." Try to find any of Washington's agendas about which the government spoke truthfully. The U.S. government is so enamored of its secret agendas that Washington never speaks truth. Keep in mind that Washington's 12 years of wars, which have doubled the U.S. national debt and left the federal government without the means to help the rising number of Americans whose jobs have been given to foreigners and whose homes are foreclosed. These have their origin in 9/11, the investigation of which was prevented by the White House. After resisting for 1 year the pressure from 9/11 family members for an investigation, the White House created a political panel to listen to the government's line and to write it down in the 9/11 Commission report. A report promptly disavowed by both co-chairmen of the commission and the chief legal advisor, all of whom described the 9/11 Commission as set up to fail. The Obama regime showed no interest in investigating how the most powerful national security state of all time, a Stasi police state that spies on the entire world, could be defeated by a few Saudi Arabians who had no support from any government or any intelligence service. or why, instead of a real investigation, the Bush White House chose an orchestrated cover-up. The U.S. government's claim to have killed bin Laden has a zero probability of being true. According to Pakistani eyewitnesses to the attack on the alleged Osama bin Laden compound in Pakistan, the Obama regime's claim is simply more theater, more lies.
Barack Obama. It was nearly 10 years ago that a bright September day was darkened by the worst attack on the American people in our history. The images of 9/11 are seared into our national memory. Hijacked planes cutting through a cloudless September sky. The Twin Towers collapsing to the ground. Black smoke billowing up from the Pentagon. The wreckage of Flight 93 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where the actions of heroic citizens saved even more heartbreak and destruction. And yet we know that the worst images are those that were unseen to the world, the empty seat at the dinner table, children who were forced to grow up without their mother or their father, parents who would never know the feeling of their child's embrace, nearly 3,000 citizens taken from us, leaving a gaping hole in our hearts. On September 11, 2001, in our time of grief, the American people came together. We offered our neighbors a hand, and we offered the wounded our blood. We reaffirmed our ties to each other and our love of community and country. On that day, no matter where we came from, what God we prayed to, or what race or ethnicity we were united as one American family.
Paul Craig Roberts, when is the last time the U.S. government told the truth about anything? Despite an unbroken history of lies, the word of the U.S. government still carries weight, especially with gullible Americans.
We were also united in our resolve to protect our nation and to bring those who committed this vicious attack to justice.
The Obama regime's story of the murder of bin Laden is nonsensical. The fact that the regime would tell such a preposterous story indicates that Washington regards the American and international public as gullible morons, people lacking any ability to discern the truth of what they are officially told. Who can believe that the terror mastermind, the head of what is said to be the most dangerous terrorist organization in the world, would be left alone, unguarded, and unarmed with only two women to protect him? Who can believe that such a defenseless person with such essential information for Washington's war on terror would simply be shot on sight by U.S. Navy SEALs? Why would Washington waste such an archive of information? Why would Washington forego the triumph of parading their captive before the world and confronting him in a courtroom with his crimes? Why would Washington dump the body secretly into the sea without even having photographic evidence to back the story? Why would Washington tell such a preposterous story for which can supply no evidence whatsoever?
We quickly learned that the 9/11 attacks were carried out by Al-Qaeda, an organization headed by Osama bin Laden, which had openly declared war on the U.S. and was committed to killing innocents in our country and around the globe. And so we went to war against Al-Qaeda to protect our citizens, our friends, and our allies. Over the last 10 years, thanks to the tireless and heroic work of our military and our counterterrorism professionals, we've made great strides in that effort. We've disrupted terrorist attacks and strengthened our homeland defense. In Afghanistan, we removed the Taliban government, which had given bin Laden and Al-Qaeda safe haven and support. And around the globe, we worked with our friends and allies to capture or kill scores of Al-Qaeda terrorists, including several who were a part of the 9/11 plot. Yet Osama bin Laden avoided capture and escaped across the Afghan border into Pakistan. Meanwhile, Al-Qaeda continued to operate from along that border and operate through its affiliates across the world. And so shortly after taking office, I directed Leon Panetta, the director of the CIA, to make the killing or capture of bin Laden the top priority of our war against Al-Qaeda, even as we continued our broader efforts to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat his network. Then last August, after years of painstaking work by our intelligence community, I was briefed on a possible lead to bin Laden. It was far from certain, and it took many months to run this thread to the ground. I met repeatedly with my national security team as we developed more information about the possibility that we had located bin Laden hiding within a compound deep inside of Pakistan. And finally, last week, I determined that we had enough intelligence to take action and authorize an operation to get Osama bin Laden and bring him to justice. Today, at my direction, the United States launched a targeted operation against that compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. A small team of Americans carried out the operation with extraordinary courage and capability. No Americans were harmed. They took care to avoid civilian casualties. After a firefight, they killed Osama bin Laden and took custody of his body. For over two decades, bin Laden has been al-Qaeda's leader and symbol and has continued to plot attacks against our country and our friends and allies. The death of bin Laden marks the most significant achievement to date in our nation's effort to defeat al-Qaeda. Yet his death does not mark the end of our effort. There is no doubt that al-Qaeda will continue to pursue attacks against us. We must, and we will, remain vigilant at home and abroad. The American people did not choose this fight. It came to our shores and started with the senseless slaughter of our citizens. After nearly 10 years of service, struggle, and sacrifice, we know well the costs of war. These efforts weigh on me every time I, as Commander-in-Chief, have to sign a letter to a family that has lost a loved one or look into the eyes of a service member who has been gravely wounded. So, Americans understand the costs of war, yet as a country, we'll never tolerate our security being threatened, nor stand idly by when our people have been killed. We will be relentless in defense of our citizens and our friends and allies. We will be true to the values that make us who we are. And on nights like this, we can say to those families who have lost ones, loved ones to al-Qaeda's terror, justice has been done. Tonight, we give thanks to the countless intelligence and counterterrorism professionals who've worked tirelessly to achieve this outcome. The American people do not see their work nor know their names, but tonight, they feel the satisfaction of their work and the result of their pursuit of justice. We give thanks for the men who carried out this operation, for they exemplify the professionalism, patriotism, and unparalleled courage of those who serve our country. And they are part of a generation that has borne the heaviest share of the burden since that September day.
Paul Craig Roberts, why would Obama, faced with a re-election campaign, forgo the patriotic publicity of a White House ceremony in which he pins medals on the victorious seals? What politician would forgo such an opportunity? Do you really believe that the SEALs' identity had to be protected in order to keep them safe from terrorists? Or that Obama would let his re-election take a backseat to such a consideration? No politician would handle the capture of Osama bin Laden in such a politically wasteful way. Can you imagine a politician throwing away such marvelous opportunities for PR events? Can you imagine an intelligence service destroying such a valuable source of information without interrogating Osama bin Laden? Now consider this. The Obama regime claims to have given bin Laden a proper Muslim burial at sea from an aircraft carrier, the Carl Vinson, named after a U.S. representative from Georgia who served in the House for more than 50 years and is known as the father of the two-ocean Navy. The aircraft carrier has approximately 6,000 personnel. From emails that sailors sent home to family and friends, none witnessed a sea burial of bin Laden. When the story of the emails got out, Washington quickly announced that bin Laden's burial was conducted in secret. No one but a few officers were involved. Think about this for a minute. First of all, here again is a massive victory over the forces of terrorism being kept from sailors whose morale it would have raised. Why keep a morale-boosting victory over terrorist evil from the crew of a deployed warship? What was achieved by the secrecy?
Finally, let me say to the families who lost loved ones on 9/11 that we have never forgotten your loss, nor wavered in our commitment to see that we do whatever it takes to prevent another attack on our shores. And tonight, let us think back to the sense of unity that prevailed on 9/11. I know that it has at times frayed, yet today's achievement is a testament to the greatness of our country and the determination of the American people. The cause of securing our country is not complete. But tonight we are once again reminded that America can do whatever we set our mind to. That is the story of our history, whether it's the pursuit of prosperity for our people or the struggle for equality for all our citizens. Our commitment to stand up for our values abroad and our sacrifices to make the world a safer place. Let us remember that we can do these things not just because of wealth and power, but because of who we are, that one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
Paul Craig Roberts. Why give up the photography of such an important American victory that could so well stimulate patriots' worship of Obama? Makes no sense whatsoever. Second, do you really believe that an at-sea burial can be conducted on a ship with 6,000 personnel, with watches being kept, with sailors on deck performing a variety of necessary functions, and no one saw? I mean, really. 6,000 people on one ship and no one saw? Were they all locked in their bunks? Now consider the fate of SEAL Team 6, whose members allegedly murdered Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad. Most shortly after the alleged hit on bin Laden, SEAL Team 6 was wiped out in Afghanistan. The Obama regime claimed that a helicopter carrying the SEAL team was shot down by the Taliban, just as the Bush regime's story of 9/11 ran into opposition from the 9/11 families. The Obama regime's story of the SEAL's demise ran into opposition from SEAL families who studied the documents that comprised the Obama regime's account. I did some interviews about the family's disbelief. The SEAL team families noticed that normal deployment operational procedures were not followed, that the entire SEAL team was loaded on a 50-year-old Vietnam War-era helicopter, not dispersed as required on their normal modern attack helicopters, and that a variety of other procedures devised to protect such expensively trained special forces were not followed. SEAL team members, according to parents, had written home expressing concerns about their safety. One told his father he'd made a will. According to parents, the SEALs themselves sensed they were in danger from internal forces, not from the external enemy. Of course, there's no proof. The criminal Obama regime will not indict itself, but just as the Carl Vinson sailors did not witness any at-sea burial of Osama bin Laden, the members of the SEAL team were asking each other, who was on the mission that got bin Laden? As it turned out, none were. Fearful of the emails that would follow the SEAL team's discovery that no one was on the mission, the team was eliminated. Oh, I know. Hollywood made a movie of the heroic SEAL team's exploits in murdering an unguarded, unarmed terror mastermind. An alleged SEAL wrote a book describing the victory of eliminating, prior to interrogation, the source of all terrorist plots, leaving the Americans in the total dark. The movie and the book are likely nothing but organized propaganda to support the government's lie. Considering the gullibility of Americans, little doubt the movie and book were successful. It plays to the emotions of the uninformed and unaware Americans that they have won. They're equally happy with when their favorite football team defeats the rival. The happiest days experienced by a generation are when Auburn defeats Alabama or vice versa. Georgia Tech defeats Georgia or vice versa. Americans are addicted to winning. They remember these victories forever. Little else is important to them. Obama told them they defeated Osama bin Laden, who died 10 years before of terminal illnesses prior to his staged murder in a propaganda event. But that's all that's important to Americans. They won. We beat bin Laden. And Obama won, despite his sellout of his every constituency and his transparent lies. Obama won re-election. Obama was an anomaly, a warmonger who won the Nobel Peace Prize. Keep in mind that prior to the Obama regime's announcement that the indispensable, exceptional country had killed bin Laden, Obama's standing was so low, the Democrats were discussing running a candidate against him for the Democratic presidential nomination. By faking an American victory over the demonized bogeyman, Obama dispensed with threats to his reelection.
The new American dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We are allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. There is no hidden black military budget. There are no UFO files Americans cannot see. No JFK documents that will not be opened during our lifetimes. No destroyed RFK murder photos by the LA police. No evidence from Ground Zero taken away before we can even look at it. We are not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream, to become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream of bringing the United States politicians, journalists, and generals who have brought about this long war and debacle to trial and put on TV, just like OJ, every afternoon, so every American can watch, just like the McCarthy hearings and the JFK funeral procession. What we need is a new American dream, not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. Right now, we live on lies, we subsist on lies, but it's not really living. 9/11 was an inside job. They all know that. What we need in America is a truth commission like they had in South Africa to heal their broken country. We need to put certain people on the stand and be allowed to ask questions. Our country is surely broken as well. The troops are not protecting us. That is somebody's spin on the day's news, somebody's advertising slogan, someone else's sermon. The troops serve the empire. They are not heroes. They kill and plunder for the empire. American bases overseas serve nobody but the empire. The heroes in our country are the protesters, the ones who go face to face with the empire, those in the plowshares movement, for one example. You have to know that Donald Trump knows the whole truth about the 9/11 attacks. Therefore, he is complicit. He has lied. He has continued the wars everywhere based on a lie, and he knows he's lying. Trump lies right to our faces on national television, just as Barack Obama did when he said that Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea. Osama bin Laden was buried at sea, and Jessica Lynch was rescued heroically. The USA does not torture. Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. George Bush won the 2000 election. And see, there is a plane there in that hole in Shanksville. It went all the way into that hole. And no, there's no blood, no bodies, no luggage scattered, or plane parts. And Osama bin Laden was buried at sea. Remember the anthrax letters which said, "Are you afraid?" Those were not written with a rock and chisel like Fred Flintstone from the recesses of some cave in Afghanistan. Those letters came from persons within our own government, like a horror movie, and the killer is in the same house with us. These killers are right here with us, and they want us to be afraid. We are not afraid. Thanks, Chuck, for all you did to produce this show, to put it together. Thanks to our guests, Julius Awafong, Michael Annis, Karen Katowski, and Anthony Rayson. And back to you, Chuck.
Well, thank all of you for listening tonight and for being with us tonight and every night here on the New American Dream Radio Show, streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all. I'm on your side. Oh, when times get rough and friends just can't be found, like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down. Like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down. When you're down and out, when you're on the street, when evening falls so hard, I will comfort you. I'll take your part. Oh, when darkness comes and pain is all around, like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down. Like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
See it, do you? How close we are to absolute chaos. The sick ones are sitting on their fat masses, eating and drink themselves into a stupor, polluting the world without a second thought while it goes down the toilet. Nobody wants to do nasty work. You know, the shit that we all just think about. Most good citizens are just along for the ride and then bitch and moan and complain about everything when it doesn't work out. Not me. Get it done.
Revolution Radio. Where we do the nasty work. www.freedomslips.com.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We gotta stop them! They're gonna kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the to make it stop, and you've got to win the game to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio of freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Right, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
Revolution.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Rebel.